Welcome to Cockpit to Cowl, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMP slash IA, and president of Social Flight.
And I'm Brian Schiff. I'm a 38-year flight instructor with a gold seal, double IMEI, and on the side to feed my hobbies, I have a side job at a major U.S. airline. I love teaching. I've been doing it ever since I was 18. So I've started a website, The Proficient Pilot, and I'm going to be propagating many, many educational content ideas through that website.
Brian, I have to say, I am so excited to be doing this show with you. This is basically taking public so many wonderful conversations that we have had through our friendship throughout the years. You have taught me so much, and we basically decided let's take these discussions public. And why make the two of us the only beneficiary of all this? So I just want to say I'm grateful for you doing this, and I'm very excited.
As am I, and I think it's like I've always said, if somebody could be a fly on the wall of our conversations, especially when you're schooling me on things mechanical or I'm schooling you on flying operational stuff, the conversations we've had are gold, and I'm happy to share those with everybody. And I really think it's going to be beneficial for other people who watch and listen to us converse about those things to learn from them as well.
Yeah, it really is wonderful. And I just want a few things for everybody that's out there. One is, of course, if you attend live this evening, then you will be getting Wings credits. In addition, a recording of this Cockpit to Cowl show will be available directly through Social Flight, where you will be able to get a Wings credit by watching it there. There'll be a quiz associated with it. It takes us a few days to get all that processed, so it won't be right away after the show, but we will get that up there. And this is not a one-time thing. Brian and I plan on doing this show monthly, and it's a great opportunity to have new topics and take so many of the things as we discussed that we've talked about before that involve both mechanical things and pilot aspects and bounce things off each other and bring it all to you for Wings credits through that. And then lastly, because I've gotten a lot of emails about this, the Cockpit to Cowl is a new show. It's in addition to Social Flight Live, as you see behind me. It's just another great opportunity for us to talk. We happen to be off this week from Social Flight Live, but we're back next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern on our normal time with a show that is spectacular. I just want to mention we have P-51D fighter pilot from World War II hero Bill Lyons. He is 100 years old. Amazing individual, incredibly with it. I'm telling you, please do not miss this show. This is one of these unique opportunities, but Social Flight Live is still there. And let's get to Cockpit to Cowl. Brian, I'm just excited to get going.
Well, I am too. Let's get talking. I'm eager to see that social flight next week, and I hope that if we have new people who don't know what social flight is, that they check out your app because I use it frequently to figure out, okay, where am I going to spend my Avgas money today? Where am I going to go? What kind of fun are we going to have? And when it's like sometimes we need an excuse to fly. We really don't need an excuse to fly because we love flying. But it's like, hey, what can I do today? And I had no idea about all the museums and restaurants and all the fun things near me until I got your app.
Thank you. I
Yeah.
love that. I just want to support aviation. So I
Yeah.
love it. So I want to get started with you because I'm being selfish here. And my
Okay.
and I am. I'm going to pick your brain first because I had a flight recently. I was coming up from North Carolina back home to New England, and IFR, IMC for most of the flight. And as I was coming north, I had something happen that really put me, I feel like, in a bind as a pilot. So I'd like to talk about your, I'd like to use your expertise. And I'm going to share an image here in order to do this. So let me see if I can do this properly.
All right, if we're going to do it as a podcast, we might have to describe it a little bit for those who
We
are just
will.
listening in.
Excellent point. There'll be an audio version of this also. So here's the story. Okay.
Okay.
I'm flying up from North Carolina. And while I'm doing this, and I'm going to make this just a little bit bigger here, while I'm en route, What I start to see is that there's some weather that's moved in during the flight time, and it is some of it is right off the coast south of New York City. So as I'm flying north, that's off to my right, off to my e off to the east, and then there's a quick moving, really violent, nasty looking cell that is west and north, northwest of New York City. And it's moving across the state of Massachusetts there, and it's pretty close to the coast. So what that leaves for everybody who's thinking about this, it leaves Long Island nice and clear. It leaves this beautiful path that lets me come up there, carve across, don't get near any thunderstorms, and get home that way. And that's exactly what I had been cleared for and what my flight plan was. So everything's going great, right? We're trucking along. We look like I wouldn't call something like this threading the needle. It's strategic weather planning as opposed to tactical. And we're going to be fine. The problem occurred when I started I'm over northern New Jersey and I'm approaching the New York airspace. And then all of a sudden, I get that call that you always get when you get close to this from McGuire Approach that
Advise when
calls and
ready to
says,
copy.
"We have an amended clearance. Are you ready to copy?" Right, exactly. And so I say, like, "Oh, yes, okay, ready to copy." And what they read me is a clearance that leads me straight into the nastiest of the nasty stuff. They were, instead of letting me go over Long Island, instead of letting me make that right-hand turn to safety, they say, "Oh yeah, you're going to go over to JFK and then you're just going to kind of keep going straight." And I look and I see purple and I see all this nasty lightning. And I say to the controller, "I can't do that. I cannot accept that clearance." I don't recall exactly, and I know we're going to find that we're going to try to get the recording. Whether I use the word unable, I believe I did, but I'm not sure.
Can't is good. I mean, I think can't is self-explanatory. And so you got a clearance that painted you into the what we're looking at as the red line up to the northwest of your current position.
Exactly. It was straight. It took me, instead of where my path was here, if you imagine this line making almost a little bit of a little bit of a left, and at that time I'm watching it move, right? So I know that massive line you see over Poughkeepsie there and that part of the image is going, instead of being there, it's going to be closer to the coast by the time I get there.
Yeah.
And so I on no uncertain terms told him, "I can't take that. And due to weather, there's extreme weather there that put me right in it. Can't do it." Here's where the surprise came. The surprise came with the answer I got back from him. His answer back to me was, "I need you to read it back to me." He said,
Wow.
"I understand what you're saying. I can put a request in to see what we can do, but I need you to read it back to me." And that really worried me because I was under the impression reading it back means I accept it. I don't want to be on a collision course with a bad cell. And I caved and I read it back and spent the rest of the flight begging for this change. So let's start there. Tell me what I need to know about this.
Yeah, so basically the regulations say that if you've been given a clearance, you have to follow it unless you have an amended clearance. If you have a TCAS traffic advisory or in the case of an emergency. So what is being given a clearance? What is a, okay, I think the FAR says obtained. When a clearance is obtained, the pilot, no pilot in command may deviate. So if you said, I can't do it, to me, that's not obtaining the clearance. He wants you to obtain the clearance because he wanted you to read it back. And it seems like a game of cat and mouse where he wanted to get this off of his back. And once you read it back, that clearance is yours, you own it. So in my mind, first of all, as a pilot, who's comfortable with my decision making at this point, but earlier in my career, a flying career, I would have been very intimidated by such a clearance. Now I know I'm not flying in that, so I'll take whatever clearance you want to give me. We'll work something out. I'm going to not go through that weather, period, obviously, because I won't come out of it alive, from what I'm looking at on the screen that you're showing. So the idea is to say unable that clearance. You did the right thing for him to, insist on you reading it back. I don't think is fair. Now, you could have played a game and said, no, I'm not reading that back. I need something else. I'm unable. Going to have to do something different than the plan that you've just given me. That puts you in a spot. You're not going to go through it. So that will lead to a request for deviation. And maybe he was expecting that, okay, once I get him on this clearance, we're going to let him deviate as needed. But he didn't tell you that. He could have easily communicated that. And since he didn't, then it leaves you in the position to play the trump card, which you have in your pocket, and that's to declare an emergency and do what you need to do. I know that I've had controllers tell me that they're just waiting for pilots to declare an emergency because once you declare an emergency, just like you're allowed to bust any FARs, they're allowed to reduce the separation standards required. They don't have to maintain the 5 mile separation from all the traffic that I presume was coming down Long Island coming into the New York area. So that's another thing that, is in your hip pocket is the declaration of emergency. You'd like to negotiate something before that happens, but obviously you're not going to fly through that weather. He played a game of cat and mouse with you, and that was not cool.
It seems like I just want to know kind of, and I'm not saying this to you. I know you're explaining it quite well, but I've been in this situation more than once, and I wish I knew really what the right way to play this is because it seems to continue to happen, and it's really stressful as a pilot. Where in this case, so here's how that played out. Here's the kind of the rest of the story, as it were. I think I asked him more than once, and he came back and said, thou shalt read this back. Like, we will figure this out, but you read this back. So I did. I caved. I read it back, and I told him how concerned I was about it. And he said, we understand. I'm communicating with the next controller. We'll see. And then once I did that and accepted that clearance, now I've gone from being feeling like I'm ahead of the aircraft, I'm ahead of the situation, and I'm really comfortable, to being highly stressed about what's going to happen next. Because now you get handed rapid sectors, as you are well aware, as you go through New York. And so it must have been four different controller shifts within 15 minutes or something. And during each one person I talk to, I've got a they're and it's getting faster and faster, right? Because you're now in JFK, all these things. And so you're trying playing that game, right, where you're desperately trying to get you push to talk in when they're
Well,
rapid
yeah, in New
firing
York,
everybody.
once you read that clearance back, you may never get a chance to talk again. That's the other reason for not accepting it. Airtime is gold there, you know?
That's the problem, right? So here I am now stuck, where each controller I desperately trying to get through and say, hey, I can't do this. And wait and finally get some opportunity where they're like, we hear you, but we're not going to be able to change it. Now, as I got closer and I got over JFK, I got the next answer, which was more clarity, where they said, I understand, but we cannot let you go over Long Island because that's where all the airline traffic is coming in. And so you're not going to be able to make a right there. We'll do what we can. And as that progresses, I'm getting closer and closer. I showed a new image here, where this is how this thing was moving. And so now it's getting closer and closer to coast. I'm looking at this and saying, there's no way I'm going, as this is moving, for example, Hartford in this, there's no way I'm going to get close to where this storm is. At some point, I'm going to push the panic button on my own and I'm going to make a right, and that's it.
Yeah,
But
and that's where you have to be comfortable with your own command authority that, okay, first of all, we're not going through that. I'm not flying through it. I'm not getting anywhere near it. So let's just see what happens as this plays out because I have the flight controls in my hand. You have the flight controls. You're going to turn the airplane to the right before you go into that weather. That's how it is. And you'll put 7700 in the box and put the airplane where you need it and then get on the ground and deal with the consequences later. That's always the out, but a pilot has to be comfortable and okay with doing that. You can't just let ATC drive. I think they probably were getting busy. Maybe that line popped up. They weren't expecting it, and they were just a bit overwhelmed and needed to just check that box where you weren't an imminent problem. They had other aircraft that may have been having more imminent needs. I'm trying to play devil's advocate of why the controller might have done that. There's always more than what we see, but you also know, and you've got to feel comfortable with the fact, well, okay, I'm not flying into that, but let's see how this plays out.
So the way it did play out in this case is all of the New York controllers kept me on that course going right at that weather and would not allow, without me doing something on my own, like you said, declare an emergency or deviate on my own. They weren't allowing anything.
So real quick, may I just describe, like I'm looking at the course line that you painted, and it's just skirting the edge, if not clipping, the front end of a squall line that's a very serious, sharply contoured line that I can guarantee with my experience is going to be right over the top of your course line when you by the time you get there.
Yeah, you see where I am. I'm down at the coil VOR.
I
So,
see that, and I'm describing it for the sake of a podcast, but yeah, I
yeah,
see
no question. So there's
that. Okay.
no question I was going to be there, and that thing was moving quickly. So I already know how this is going to play out for me.
Yeah.
What ended up happening is New York kept me on this kind of course of doom the entire time, and then essentially, they were, as you mentioned, extremely busy. And so they basically were, we're not gonna help you. And then
Yeah.
when they handed me to Providence, when I was finally touching the coastline of Connecticut and starting to get too close for comfort to that, that's when they handed me out of their sector. And Providence was wonderful. And the wonderful controller there, she basically said, do whatever you need right now. Like you're. But that wasn't until New York dumped me out. And so, talk to me a little bit about making your own plan aside from what you're given, because I think that's kind of the only thing, but it's just so stressful.
Yeah, it is stressful, and it's not fair to put that upon you. I would venture to wager that the controller was stressed out, and I know for a fact that, the ace in the hole that your trump card is that you're going to declare an emergency, and you can do whatever you need to, and the controller can do what he needs to at that point, and the separation. I spoke with a controller who actually told me that the separation is not the same. They can actually break the separation. Doesn't have to be 5 miles. They can go down to 3 or 2, do what they have to do to meet this. But I think the controller didn't have time to make you feel comfortable because he had probably had a lot of other stuff to do. As I look at this route, and you're going to be coming closer to it as it approaches and wedges into your flight path, I would make a plan. It's like if I'm looking at this, I would make a plan. Well, after this point, there's some uncertainty as to the accuracy of NEXRAD. So I'm going to factor that in. I'm going to be very conservative and say, let's say this weather's old and I'm going to assume see how far it moves in 20 minutes, and I'm not going to get any closer than that. I'm going to make a right turn. Let me ask you though, were you IMC or
Yes,
VMC?
most of it I was IMC. I was in and out, so I would consider it all to be IMC because it was certainly
Yeah, okay. So you
not
couldn't see
something like that.
this. Yeah, okay.
No, and therefore, of course, and we can talk about it in a minute, but we don't want to, I wouldn't want to use it as this weather as a tactical tool.
Sure.
I wasn't trying to pick through anything. To me, again, there was a safe route, and this was really moving fast. So you're talking about weather now that was moving around 30, 40 knots.
Yeah.
So to give you an idea, by the time I end up deviating, I didn't make it to my destination.
You mean diverting?
Diverting,
So
excuse me.
where did you go?
I
You
went to
ended up.
Plymouth. I went into Plymouth,
Okay.
and so I ended up turning over the sound and staying away from it before I reached the coast, and going until I came to Cape Cod and just putting down there. And at
Okay.
that point I was, 45 minutes ahead of it hitting.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, that
So
sounds like a good ending. I mean, you did the right thing.
yeah, it is. It's interesting what you mentioned there. I want to grab onto for a second, and that is, I think about saying that I am deviating due to weather and just saying I'm just doing it now. And as you mentioned, you can divert in terms of where you're going to land. I was not thinking about pulling the emergency trump card. Tell me more about that.
So I think you always need to have that in your hip pocket. And I remember my instructor, who shares my last name, teaching me, you declare an emergency when you're not getting what you need from ATC. Obviously, we're not going to declare an emergency to get priority because I don't want to hold. I don't want to use it to get ahead of people. So we're not talking about taking advantage of that. We're talking about I have a problem. I need this. I'm not getting it. I've had some problems where ATC, I was the only one they were working with, and they could give me whatever I needed. There was no real need to declare an emergency. So when you need to violate a rule, or when you expect ATC to violate a rule or give you priority, you need to be prepared to declare an emergency. And I've had to do so several times. One time was very similar to this. I was actually fortunate enough to be in the right seat in a Cessna 414 with my father, and we were flying a VFR flight following, and it was just like this, and weather was wedging us into restricted airspace. And he said, I'm not going to be able to stay clear of the restricted airspace. It was also building behind us. And ATC said, well, are you IFR equipped, and are you IFR capable? We'll give you a clearance into the weather. And it looks similar to what you're looking at right here. There's no way we're going to take an IFR clearance into that. So he said, negative, I'm not taking a clearance into that. It's convective, it's thunderstorms, we're not doing that. And so they came back and said, well, we don't know what say your intentions. So at this point, we're like, okay. He just calmly declared an emergency. He said, I'm going to squawk 7700 and turn right, and I'm going to fly into restricted airspace and get around this weather. We couldn't get back. It was building up behind us as well, and it was really watching him just so cool and collected, declare an emergency, fly into the restricted airspace, and ATC was gracious after that. They said, yeah, give us a call when you land, let's talk about it. But we landed. The thing that a pilot needs to remember is you want to do what you have to do to get on the ground safely. A lot of pilots worry about paperwork or reports. I've declared many emergencies and never been asked to write a report, but they might want to discuss it afterwards. And that's what happened here. And the controller apologized and said, if we'd have given you the option of going 1,000 feet higher, you would have been above the restricted airspace. But he didn't offer that at the time, and he apologized, and that's how it ended. Nothing ever was heard of it. But we're fortunate enough to have survived it, not turned it into a big emergency, because we did what we had to do. So, yeah, I mean, you have to be prepared to do that and be okay with doing it and not be afraid of it. Don't be intimidated to declare an emergency. A lot of pilots are. You just have to be okay with it and convince yourself, hey, I'm the pilot in command. Like I said, I was fortunate enough to watch my dad as a role model on that, and I got to see how easy it is to declare an emergency. And it was almost like air traffic control thanked us, because now that opens up a whole toolbox for them to help me.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's interesting because to me, you mentioned reduced separation, which gives you other options. I like the idea. I like the idea less of just sitting there in a situation like this and just having to wait until I hit my personal limit and then just say, I'm deviating right due to weather, like deal with it, versus I need to do this. I'm declaring an emergency so that I can stay out of this because of this clearance, and I'm going to start deviating right. I would much rather be cooperating with them at that point because I want them to, I'd rather them say, proceed to this VOR or intersection. I'd rather be on something than feel like I'm just abandoning you guys because you're not working with me, and I'm gonna, make a right turn and see how this works out.
I think it's important to understand what's happening on the other end of the microphone. The controller has probably got a lot of puzzles to work out, and the controller's primary objective is to keep airplanes from hitting each other. Nowhere in their MO is it to keep you out of bad weather. I mean, the controller's responsibilities are not to keep you out of weather. You, as a pilot, are responsible to stay out of bad weather. So you have to tell the controller what you need, and if they can't give it to you, you need to find a better plan or declare an emergency. That's really your only options. And I asked if you were VMC, because that's always an option when you're IFR and can't get a clearance to what you need. You can always, if the weather's good enough, just cancel, go VFR, and do what you need to do.
Yeah, that certainly makes a lot of sense, and I can definitely appreciate this one worked out great. We just made it home a little later in the day, which is the way you should in a situation like this. But I think next time I will, if this situation occurs again, I will pull the emergency card. And The other thing that's in, a lot of times it seems, in some cases, especially when things are not busy, you feel like you're on the same side as the controller, just like I was with the Providence controller at the end. Sometimes I'll tell you, more than once, I have kind of been butting heads with a controller, putting me in a weather, and it's always been about a sector boundary. It's always been about someone saying, if you keep going, like I'm staying away from weather, and they're like, you keep going that way, you're not going to be in my sector. I can't let you keep going that way.
Ooh, I mean, I have to talk to somebody else. I've gone around weather so far that I wound it up in Mexico, and they had to do a whole lot of work on their end. And it's human nature to want to have the other person do more work than you and have them deal with the problem and kick the can. But you got to do what you got to do. I didn't care if he had to do some coordinating with Mexico. I'm like, that's great, do it. I'm going that way. So we did. It turned out to be no big deal. So, they might try to talk you out of things, but you as the pilot in command have to determine what's best. You have to weigh everything out.
The other thing I want to throw out there and make sure we're starting as we as the show is Cockpit Decals, we start talking a little bit more about the machine itself. When we talk about looking at weather like this, I think it's really important that people understand we're not I was not equipped with weather radar. This is I have on board the aircraft two sources of weather depiction, graphical NEXRAD depiction. One is ADS-B and one is Sirius XM. So one from satellites, one from ground base. Fortunate to have both of those on the plane. And I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize how old that data can be.
It's a lot of great, fantastic information telling you where the weather was. So, yeah, and you used a term that I really like. You said strategic, not tactical. So strategic for long-range planning. I'm looking, okay, I want to stay over Long Island. But if you're going to use that weather radar to tactically, I see a hole and it's 2 miles wide and I'm going to go through that hole. No, that hole was there 10 to 20, maybe even more minutes ago. And you're going to where the weather wasn't 20 minutes ago. So that doesn't mean that's where it is. You cannot use it for that. And it's really sad that we unfortunately lose several aircraft every year to flying into weather that they thought was okay because they were looking at outdated information on NEXRAD or Sirius XM. But I know that because I'm thinking it, somebody watching it must be thinking it. Because what do you prefer? I have NEXRAD. I haven't had Sirius XM in my airplane. Which one do you like better?
Oh man, there is no question that the in from my personal experience of having both and always watching both at the same time, there's no question that the Sirius XM weather looks better and tends to be, in my experience, more accurate to what's really happening out there.
Is it a more frequent
But
update?
well, it is. And so let's chat about that. Again, people do like hour, 2 hour, 3 hour long shows, all just based on radar and interpretation. We can't get into that. But here's what matters for a trip like this that I would and the situation I was in. For anyone who's not really familiar with it, so radar is done. We all know, we've seen the old things, how it sweeps and does a 360-degree sweep. When what it actually does is it has to look at different altitudes, right? You have a ground-based radar. We're still using ground-based radar stations. That's how it all works. And it does a 360-degree sweep, takes about 20 seconds, and it has one angle, and it starts down at, I think it's like 5 degrees, and then it ratchets the angle up more and more. I'm using my hands the other way. It should be more like this, starting like this, ratcheting it up, 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 up in a cone to see really what's out there, because it doesn't know what altitude. It has to put together a composite picture of it all. By the time, you can almost think of it as spirals, but it's cuts. By the time it's gotten this whole picture done, and then it goes back to the base, it's about 6 minutes. And so that's just gathering the data. And then it has to process it, which is pretty quick. And then it has to transmit it out to you in the aircraft. Well, the transmit times that you have are different based on whether it's ADS-B or whether it's XM.
Let me stop
They
you for a
both.
sec. It not only has to transmit it, so once it builds that picture, that's one radar site. The next rad is a mosaic, a pattern, a quilt pattern of all the different radar sites put together, right? So all of those have to come in, and a computer has to analyze and digitize and make the master quilt from all those pictures, and that takes a
That
few
is correct.
minutes.
That is correct. And if you look at something like, let's say, XM, you're getting it's getting sent out to you every 2.5 minutes, but that doesn't mean it's different data every 2.5 minutes. It's different data every 5 minutes. So it's updating it on a at a 5 minute. Is there something new to update?
But that doesn't mean it's 5 minutes
It's
old.
repeating it because you might not have been listening at that moment. So it's like repeating. So when you add all these delays up, it's a pretty safe time frame to say, look, this is going to be 10, 15 minutes late. And 10, 15 minutes in a fast moving storm or cell or something is an eternity.
Well, if it's moving 35 miles an hour, it's going to move one fourth of that. In that amount of time, in 10 minutes, it's going to move, 5, 6 miles. So if you're talking about a 2 or 3 mile hole, but the weather's already moved 5, 6 miles, might even be growing. And we don't even know what altitude we're really looking at for this mosaic of weather. So there's a two-dimensional picture we're looking at playing in a three-dimensional world.
Right. And that doesn't even account, of course, for something which I've also learned during too many years looking back, too much gray hair of flying, which is by human nature, we like to look at these gorgeous images and think of them as being static cells that move. Right. I think that's how the human brain tends to default to processing it. Anytime you look at it, like that rain is going to be in this place at this time. If I watch it, I can estimate. That doesn't account for the fact that that's actually not how it works. It's going to change shape. It's going to leapfrog. It's going to, something that wasn't there is going to pop
Bottom
up.
line, don't get anywhere near it. I mean, don't get anywhere near that kind of weather. And when I say don't get near it, I mean 20 miles away. Don't get any closer than 20 miles, and that's just a gouge, depending on the speed that it's moving. Unless you have onboard weather radar that's scanning live, looking at a picture of weather radar, if you have XM or Sirius or whatever kind of display you have, if you're using a tablet or an iPad with ForeFlight, ForeFlight is the same thing. It's delayed. It'll show you the timestamp that ForeFlight received that weather. Doesn't mean that's the time that that weather existed that you're looking at. I took a very cool video that maybe I'll share in a future one of looking down at my iPad, showing the NEXRAD weather. Then I look up at the weather radar. And so the NEXRAD shows this thunderstorm off to my left. I pan up to the weather radar. The weather radar shows the thunderstorm is off to my right. And then we look out the window, and lo and behold, it's over there. But if you'd have looked at your iPad and the NEXRAD to avoid that, you would go, man, I'm making a right turn. And you look out the window, and that would have taken you directly into this thunderstorm. So you cannot use it for deviating or tactical circumnavigation of weather. That's not what it's for. It's big picture stuff. It's for getting the METAR at your destination. And looking, 100 miles down the road, what's happening? Is the line building? And so on. A good lesson. And it absolutely needs to be said as well. So that's the kind of stuff that I think this conversation, I hope that people watching this pass that on to others, because there's just too many accidents of people that didn't get the memo that, hey, you cannot deviate around weather with this.
Got it.
We're talking about the airplane. Since we're talking about the machine and all, I know that since I bought my airplane, I was always, I've had a couple airplanes. But when I bought my Citabria, and I had my first annual and I got it back, and since you and I have become friends, I've told you hey, I had this happen, or mechanic told me this, and you ought to do that. And boy, have I learned some things. I was an idiot as far as maintaining an airplane or knowing about the airplane. You can't just get in the airplane like you get into your car, and drive it. You need to know about it, even if you're whether you're an aircraft owner or an aircraft renter. So what I did, when I first started instructing, I had a student one time, and I wanted to teach him about the aircraft and how to pre-flight it and how the systems work and show him things. And while we're out there pre-flighting, I looked over at the hangar and I saw that there's another 172. It looks just like ours, with the cowling off and the mechanic who I knew working on it. And I said, this is a great opportunity. And I think I heard my dad say this one time, one of the pieces of advice he gave me years ago that just went in one ear and stopped here, thankfully. So it's in there. But we walked over to the hangar and I asked him, I said, "Hey, can you just show us a few things? You know, we in a pre-flight, we do a magneto check. Where's the magneto? What's that look like?" And so seeing it there and having a mechanic show it to you led me to the advice my dad gave me years ago: pay a mechanic for an hour of their time to just show you the idiosyncrasies of your airplane, show you the insides. Maybe during the annual, maybe just if you're renting something, go to the hangar and see one that's being worked on a similar type. You can learn so much. And I think pilots and mechanics need to interact.
I totally agree with you, and it's I always smile when I hear your stories about things like that because to me you're already at the graduate course level of these things because obviously of your experience as a flight instructor and most of the times that I'm trying to be a standard bearer or make a rallying cry for pilots to learn things, they're not even close to the level of you saying, "Hey, I have my students go talk to an AMP, go look at these things." They're nowhere near that. I think we have a really serious challenge out there because so many pilots, even if they own their own aircraft, don't seem to understand what they really need to about the plane in order to be safe. And I want to stress that idea of it's enough to be safe. There's a lot of people out there. If we talk about students and renters, then and what flight instructors that I see in most cases are teaching, it's like look for bird's nest, check for oil, a couple things where they wiggle or control
Freedom of
surges.
movement and general security.
Yeah, like very little, that they it's sort of the basement. And then if it's aircraft owners, a lot of times the part that makes me, bite my tongue is when you get people that just keep saying, "I trust my mechanic, I trust my mechanic, trust my mechanic." Your mechanic's not with you when you're up there in the air. They're not with you when you're doing the pre-flight, even if you trust them. Like there's a duty, I think, as aircraft owners and as pilots in general, even if you don't own a plane, to we take on it's not a car, as you mentioned. You can't pull over if something happens. And therefore, you can't just say, "I trust someone else," or "I just don't know, I'm not very mechanical." There's a certain amount of knowledge I just wish people would accept they have to know. And it's to me, it's those things that would hurt you. That's the way I characterize it.
And I'd like to, as we progress with this podcast, we're going to be talking about a lot more of those little things, those golden nuggets that, hey, if you know this about that system, when this happens, you can fix it like this. Or here's how to recognize an issue. I had an airplane that was, it was a rental aircraft one time, and I remember telling you that I lost a cylinder that started vibrating really bad in flight, declared emergency, beeline to the runway, landed, and everything was fine. Well, the post-flight, the mechanic walks up, he takes the cal, and I was like, okay, you're stressed out. Like, what do I do in an emergency? I teach this every day. But all of a sudden I'm faced with it, and it's like, wait. What? So this is the real deal. I'm trying to do okay, my backwards L, looking through everything. I'm trying everything I can to get this engine going again. It's not going to happen. It's vibrating like crazy. I'm using as little power as I can. Just want to get it on the ground, landed downwind on a long runway, just so I could not have to fly a pattern in case the rest of the engine fails. We don't teach about partial power failure. We teach about total engine power failure, and that's another thing we should talk about. We'll get to that later. But when I got on the ground, I remember talking to you afterwards, and you telling me something that really hit me hard is that you shouldn't have an engine failure. You shouldn't have an engine problem. And what happened was it lost a valve. So one of the valves failed. And so basically I'm running on three cylinders because a valve was wide open. I think it broke, or I don't know what happened to it, but it failed. So you said it didn't have to happen. And I'm like, what do you mean it didn't have to happen? Things break. And the airplane had 100 hours, it was with an annual and blah, blah, blah. And so you told me something that could be done during the annual. It's not required, but a good, prudent idea to do it, something with the valves. What was that?
Well, that was in like homings, the sticking valves that can
Okay.
happen that's out there and the wobble check.
But the fact is, you can do more than the minimum as required. So as a pilot, you can ask a mechanic when they work on your annual. Hey, can you do this? Can you do that? But I don't know what to ask him to do until I met you and we talk about it. Well, that's what I think this kind of researcher asking another mechanic, every pilot should have a mechanic friend so that you have a third party not trying to make money from you. But learning these gotchas are important to not only dealing with the problem in flight, because if you understand and know how it works, you can deal with it better, but also preventing it by doing the right kind of maintenance or ensuring that your flight school does this during their annuals. If you're shopping for a flight school.
That definitely makes sense, and I of course agree with that. I think one of the areas and something I want to work on, and we can work on it together, is how to go into detail and maybe create a course that gives that level of education for pilots. I always say and aircraft owners, but for pilots to understand enough about their aircraft. And I do always latch on to that, what can hurt you? Because there's lots of stuff out there for preventive maintenance and what's the best thing for cost savings and longevity of the aircraft and all sorts of stuff that is great and really important and the best way to operate a plane and understand it. But there's also a subset that's a lot easier to understand. And that is you can go spinner to tail. You can go around the whole airplane with a mechanic and be taught what do I need to know? What can hurt me in this area? And I don't
That's
mean, they
huge.
start right at the prop
I'd
and
pay
you
money for
say,
that information.
yeah, well, let's start right at the prop, right? And sit there and go, as an example, what can hurt you here? And they can sit there and say, all right, you wibble, wobble the spinner and make sure it's secure because that thing flies off. You don't want that. That can cause issues more, but let's look at the prop itself. If it's a composite prop, if it's any prop, here is what a dangerous level of kind of like ding or rock thing or anything else is, what you have to worry about and what you don't worry about. That's just erosion or normal stuff. But you lose a chunk of a prop in flight that can hurt you. You know about things like a hub and what it. What is oil streaking that's kind of just leaking out look like versus what you look at that needs to be looked at because it could be a crack in the hub or something. This is just pre-flight stuff. This is like understand it enough so that you have confidence in saying, I'm going to call off this flight and have someone look at it because I know I've been told that if I grab the tip and it really is wobbling, someone needs to look at it because that could hurt me.
And you told me with respect to my, engine failure, there may have been signs. There may have been something that you could have seen to recognize where, the new CFI that's teaching me to fly, or even an experienced one for that matter, may not have known that this is just the way a normal engine starts. What did you tell me? I forget.
Well, so you look at something like Lycomes and Continentals, and in your case, you had a Lycoming. And this is not so much direct pre-flight as it is knowing about the aircraft. Lycoming, each of those engines are incredibly reliable, right? There's a reason that we feel so safe and secure flying behind them. But when something's really reliable, then you also know what the you can kind of narrow down what are the things that cause them not to work when they do fail. This is how they fail. And Lycomings, they each have valve issues. Lycomings valve issues are that valves can stick. And if a valve sticks where it's open, then the piston, it doesn't go back. The piston comes up and hits it, or it can fracture, and you can ruin your whole day on that cylinder very, very quickly. Well, what's interesting about the Lycoming approach to that, or Lycoming side of this equation, is that there's usually symptoms about this. If you go out and the engine starts rough fairly often, and then gradually smooths out, and then everything's fine. We like to call that morning sickness in the industry. And that's like it's sticking until the cylinder heats up and gives it enough clearance it can move. And if you catch this, then it's really easy to solve. Like it's not a required thing to do for maintenance, but there's a something called a wobble check. You can see if it's got clearance. There's a tool you can go and you can clean up the valve guide. It's not expensive. And so if you're experiencing something like this, if you ever see it, the first question then for someone who knows it's a light coming is to ask the shop, like, hey, have the valve guides been inspected on this? How often do you do it? That's
Well,
it's
I
not
think
like you
it's
can catch
tough.
100%.
Yeah, it's tough for a pilot to try to be expected to ask those kinds of questions. But I think it's easy for a pilot to pay attention to how the airplane normally starts, the sights, the sounds, the smells. I can tell if a car has an antifreeze leak by how the exhaust smells. Okay, that's experience. I did have a rental aircraft I was flying. In fact, it was probably that one that started up rough and after a short period got smooth. Not anything that ever concerned me. I just figured it was rich and it's burning off whatever, and insert your own pilot terminology here. I just figured it was okay. Well, those are the symptoms, I think, that kind of symptom check is important for us, for pilots, to understand what to look for. This is not okay if it's this. Other airplanes I see, they're leaking like oil, like a sieve. I used to fly the MD-80, and I would write it up if it wasn't leaking oil, because that meant it was out of oil. But I don't think it's okay to have a massive oil leak on the bottom of the airplane. It's not okay to fly an airplane, in my opinion, you correct me if I'm wrong, that the belly's caked with oil.
Well, it's all the definition of what is massive and things like that, of course. But this is where, again, it goes back to what's likely to hurt you. What are the things you need to know? Like we said, valves can hurt you if they go bad and they are a weak spot in some cases. Exhaust can hurt you if something goes bad. Fuel in the cockpit or in the engine compartment that's coming out where it shouldn't can hurt you. Oil, less likely. But I mean, either way, you can go around the whole plane and create what is essentially a short list. It's not too bad. But the things that are on this list are things that pilots should know. Like they should really know about that.
Well, I think we should go over that list next time we do this.
I'm up to it. I'm game for
I'd
that.
love to hear that, because that's what's like when I hear a friend just got a disease and but he caught it too late. What do I want to know? Well, what were your symptoms? Because I don't want that to happen to me. And we can take that to the airplane for sure. And there's a lot of things we can do to pay attention to the norm. Was if every time you start the engine in this kind of weather, the oil pressure comes up within 10 seconds, and then one day it doesn't, it takes 30, 40 seconds. Okay, something's different. Okay, that's why if we always look at these things, we always know where the airplane is trending, and we can watch. If we just start it up, cruise, and open up a magazine and never pay attention, we can't identify a trend. So I teach pilots to do a lot of trend monitoring. And of course, now we have engine monitors that do that for us, some airplanes, and do a great job of that. But I think it would be worth its weight in gold. And I've done this, and I would encourage others, if you pay an instructor for an hour of their time, why wouldn't you pay a mechanic for an hour and say, hey, show me a pre-flight. Show me what's going to get me. I would love
So
that.
I want to quiz you with a couple things because I want to ask you, this isn't a test. This is a literally me learning what you tell as a flight instructor and try to understand because for me, I think one of the big gaps I see in pilots is their understanding of how to manage some engine or mechanical issues when they fly, which goes back to understanding the system. We do mag checks on the ground, right? That's how most people do their, just before they go, they just where they pull on the runway, they do their run up, they check the mags, et cetera. I'm amazed. What do you instruct someone to do when the engine goes when they experience roughness in an airplane? What are the things that are on that you teach students are on that list?
Well, fuel, air, and ignition. Somewhere there's a problem, right? Or there could be some foreign substance in there, or we could have something out of a prop out of balance, or it could be an engine out of balance. So in my case, it was an engine out of balance. But with respect to the way it's firing, if the prop you can't do anything about. Obviously, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to try and preclude this with a good pre-flight. Second thing you're going to do is pay attention to the, like you said, the things that can get you and learn what they are. So I really want to learn those. Third is I don't want to take an airplane into the air if the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up because I see this or that or whatever. So if you see something, don't take it in the air. So number one is don't get in that situation. Do the best you can to avoid it. Secondly, if you're in the air and something like that happens, Now, you kind of intimated with the magnetos and checking them on the ground, but I certainly would try one mag at a time in the air if I had a rough running engine. That was one of the things I would do, like in a Cessna. I teach a backwards seven or upside down L, whatever you want, starting at the fuel, make sure it's on both and not about to flame out because it's running, rough and about to run out of fuel. Come up and mix your prop, carb heat, or alternate air if that's the case, because it could be icing, come across. And when I get to ignition, don't just make sure it's in both and say, yeah, it's in both. Try one mag at a time. Go and see how it runs on one mag. That's one of the checks. Of course, the primer should be in and locked, and you don't push on it to do that. You pull on it and make sure it doesn't come out.
I wish more pilots actually did some of that stuff. The things I've seen most commonly taught when they have engine issues are generally about complete engine stoppage or power loss, like reduction. And usually they're just teaching about like, okay, well, if it's complete loss, we go straight to fuel, right? Are you on the correct tank? Did you run out of gas and whatever? And then if you're losing it, of course, we talk about carb heat and what carb icing can do. And I think those are really commonly taught. It seems, I may get a skewed perspective, but it seems far less frequent that pilots are taught and students are taught that about a rough running engine, where you go for that, and that you should be checking the mags, as you mentioned. You should be changing the mixture at that point. But independently testing these things.
So I encourage pilots to be very familiar with, and it shouldn't just be my encouragement. Your gold star number 1A pilot will do this anyway, but be familiar with the emergency procedures section of your POH, because it probably has a section on a rough running engine. And depending on the kind of engine you have, there may be different things that you want to do. Are you turbocharged? Are you fuel injected? There's a lot of different variables that come into play there. But first of all, be familiar with that checklist. And I don't want to usurp any kind of manufacturer recommendations. Those are usually there for a reason, for sure.
No,
But you're right. I generally don't think that we teach what to do in a rough running engine.
but you at an airline, right? You have checklists, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have checklists that you use and you pull out the checklist for, and then you have red box items that you're expected to have memorized. Is that correct? Because there's no time to pull that. As student, as owners of an aircraft or pilots of an aircraft or anyone commanding an aircraft, to me, I think we're missing, where are those boxed items? Where are those things that have to be muscle memory? Your engine's
Comply with
rough.
me and I'll show you, because the checklist that I use has that. My students have memory items. If you have an engine fire in flight, any of my students will know exactly what the first step is. When I ask that on a flight review, people will go, the mixture, the fuel shut off, pull the power back. What's the first step of an engine fire in flight? Hang on, I'm on fire. I'm going to get my manual out here. And you don't have time for that. So I encourage, every flight before you go flying, read one emergency procedure and you'll pick it up.
What I want to see is that I think some people do it for, like you said, engine fire, complete loss of engine power. I don't think we do it for roughness. And let me give you an example why that is so important. There was an incident that I was working with someone on, that they had a rough running engine. They did not diagnose it in the air. They tried to figure out where they were going to go. They focused on the, I'm not going to fault them in this regard. I mean, they focused on the pilotage side of it, where I need altitude. I need to find where I'm going to go land. I need to do all of this. And at that point in time, what they were dealing with was a rough running engine still producing plenty of power. They did not make any changes to the engine or their controls. They did not try to diagnose it. The approach that I think they took was just that. I'm not going to touch anything, and it could just get worse. I'm just going to focus on getting somewhere. What ended up happening is that the engine ended up just basically, turning into a pile of metal. And the reason that happened in this case, not that they would have known immediately that this is what's going on, but in looking back, what happened was one of the magnetos had failed, and it had failed in a way that it had lost a number of teeth, and it was firing still, but far advanced.
Oh, wow.
So you had one magneto working properly and one magneto firing the spark way more in advance of the piston stroke coming on than it should be. That produces plenty of power, I guess,
So
unless
one
it's
magneto for all cylinders, or like one cylinder in that one magneto?
So it was the timing was became wrong on one magneto. It was still producing power to all cylinders.
So all
So
cylinders were getting an off-time spark.
yes, so all
Wow.
cylinders, because of the teeth that had been lost on the magneto, and the way it had skipped, it was had an advanced timing. So you had one spark plug firing early and
Interesting.
the other spark plug firing on time. What happened and what was being perceived there was extreme detonation. The
Yeah.
engine's temps spiked, and the only thing that needed to be done
Go to one
to
mag.
preserve this was switch mags, test mags.
Yeah, wow. So that's a great diagnostic tool, which I've used without really understanding why. I mean, without understanding the depth of what you just described, it's something that I've done. So you just reassured the fact that I do that. But I just figure I got two systems. And this is the dumb Brian simple system. I got two systems. It's ignition is one of the players here. A fuel tank is another player. I could switch tanks, switch a fuel. Try one at a time and see. And that's one of the things I teach. Now, I want to point out, don't test your mags in flight under normal circumstances. I don't think that's something that I want to be telling people to do, as a
Why?
routine. Well,
Why?
because it's an opportunity to screw up. I try to reduce the opportunities to screw up, especially when you're me. If
Okay.
there's a
I
way
will
to do it,
I will beg to respectfully differ with you on that one just because,
okay, why?
well, because we actually do that. We actually do in the work that I do with Savvy and Mike Bush, the work we do other places. It's a
Yeah.
diagnostic tool. We have people go up all the time. And run on and do a mag check, run on the right mag, run on the left mag, go back to both, and then we can
Yeah.
see in the data what's happening within each of the cylinders. I would actually rather there's very little risk to it. I mean, it goes
Well,
to
so
off on
you're talking about in flight.
in flight,
You're talking about a
absolutely.
diagnostic, but I wouldn't do it as a routine, like, oh, and final every time I'm gonna check my
Oh
mag.
God, no. I
Okay.
guess what we're talking about extremes here, and the extreme
Yeah,
that I'm
yeah.
seeing. And maybe I have a skewed view of things, but the extreme that I see is most pilots I have spoken to are not comfortable
Yeah.
using their mag switch in flight.
Yeah.
They worry about doing it. And I think you need to be comfortable with that. I think you
Well,
need to
what
be
if it's
comfortable in
on left
cruise
mag?
going from both to left. And by the way, if you have a rough running engine and you have a mag problem causing this, then when you go to one of those two settings, the engine will probably go quiet. And when you go to the other, it will become much nicer. So, yeah, that's part of the process.
So I'm just a dumb old pilot. I'm afraid if I go to off while the thing is spinning real fast and pumping fuel into it, and then I go back to turning the ignition back on, what happened? I know Mike Bush is in favor of it. I know that I've heard you guys talk about it. I know that it's not a dangerous thing, but I'm afraid when the engine is spinning to go to off and then back, for any amount of time and then go back on, I feel like I'm going to ignite a pool of fuel. Not
No,
true?
I mean, I hear you, and that is what we are trained through experience to
Yeah.
believe because we're used to doing it on the ground. And when you're doing it
Yeah.
on the ground, a starter is all you have turning it. And when it's not turning, you're just pulling fuel in. When you're in the air and that propeller is just racing along, your engine is an engine, whether it's firing or not. It is
So it's pushing everything
compressing,
out the exhaust.
exhausting,
Okay.
whatever's in it. If instead you have air and no fuel, or fuel and air and no spark, whatever's happening is going through that engine the same way. It can't sit there. And so that you don't generally have to do that. Now, it's not like I'm a fan of kill your engine in flight and hope it restarts. I'm just saying, what are your
Well, I've
risks?
done that. I don't have a. I've done that too.
Yeah.
Under certain circumstances, Dad and I were testing to see if an airplane glides better at idle or with the engine off. So we had to
There you
try it
go.
both ways. But under certain circumstances, we took precautions and all that. But no, that makes sense, and that's good. And so I'm constantly learning. Like I said, I'm glad that we're just having these conversations with other people, at least listening, so that I'm not the only one benefiting from it, and you're not the only one benefiting from it. So this is really cool. I'm glad we're doing this.
I love it too, and maybe what we will do in some of our future episodes is maybe we'll bring out one or more items each time that we do this show that are kind of like these are the things that can hurt you,
I like that. I really like
because
the
I
idea of
just want
looking.
people to know that. That's my passion is if you're going to be a pilot, I just don't want you to simply say, I love my mechanic. He's the best guy in the world. The bigger check I write him, the better I feel. Because that's not good enough. He's not with you in the cockpit when things go down. I want you to know what can hurt you. And then we can spend all day long talking about all the ways that you can be the best owner possible and save
Well,
the
see,
most
that's
money
what
and
I
fly the
do.
biggest
He say
plane.
he's not in the cockpit. I make my mechanic go with me on the first flight after every annual.
Okay, that is definitely on our next show because I'm with you. I mean, okay.
Like,
Taking a
I'm giving
plane.
you a ride. We're going for a ride. If he says no, I'm not getting in that airplane, neither am I.
Okay, there is no question next time we are going to talk about taking an aircraft and for flight after maintenance because that is the highest risk time. And it is a whole subject into itself. I very much want to talk to you about that.
And I want to
Unfortunately, we're
talk
out
to
of
you
time
about,
tonight.
yeah, and I want to talk to you about how pilots should write up discrepancies and what your pet peeves are, and maybe give some advice to pilots about how to write up some discrepancies, because
Love
I've
it.
seen some
Love
atrocious
it.
things.
Well,
Yeah,
for
but you
everybody
want
listening tonight, you've known these are the conversations we have. Hopefully, give us a thumbs up, send us a message, and let us know what you think and what you want to see happen. There's also a survey on your screen right now because we do, of course, want to know what your preferred days of the week are to have this show. We are not stopping Social Flight Live. We've got some amazing guests coming up on that, but this is the
Can't you do Social
conversation.
Flight Live and do this at the same time? We could just, like, when I'm talking, you go do Social Flight. When your
I
guest
love
is
that.
talking,
Yeah, I could do
you
the same. I
kind
could
of.
that would really and talk about efficiency. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, definitely don't stop that. I love you're getting some fantastic guests, some
Thanks.
people you're getting. We're getting to hear from some prime people in the industry that we would never get to hear from. That's really cool.
I'm not even telling you some of the people on my list I'm trying to get because I'm just hoping it all works out. But we've got some amazing folks coming. But Brian, I want to say thank you to you. It's not just a mutual appreciation club. The way we talked about you helped me in figuring out how to handle weather. That's the purpose of this show. Let's talk about all things from mechanic, pilot, and flight instructor. And I hope that people have gotten something out of that this evening, and they want to keep seeing a show like this happen.
Well, we have so much more, obviously, and we've got it, queued up, and we'll talk about it and we'll share it. I think that's awesome. And I would like to just end with a quote that's on my website, because this is I was asked, is flying dangerous? And I answered. I said, you know what? Let me think about that for a second. I don't want to come right out and say it's dangerous, but a little bit of fear is okay because it makes you do the right thing. So I came up with my answer to that question, and that is that flying involves hazards. Okay, how a pilot deals with those hazards can make it safe or dangerous. So it's up to you to make flying safe or dangerous.
I love that. I love that. And I think when I first heard that quote and I loved it so much, I was thinking only from the piloting perspective. And now I've embraced it in my world of maintenance as well,
Yeah.
because I think it's the same thing. I think there is risk associated with the machines that we fly. And therefore, it's how you manage that risk. It's how you understand it that
Right.
determines whether that flight will be safe or not. And so there's a lot that we can do. So we will get to everybody with the next show date. I think we have a preliminary one coming up, but it's going to be our monthly show, probably continuing on Wednesdays, but in addition to Social Flight Live. So again, Brian, thank you so much for joining us and for everything that we do on this. And thank you to everyone who took time out of their evening, out of all of your evenings, to join us here. And you can also send notes to info@socialflight.com if you want to reach me. And Brian, is there an email also for you
Yeah,
to?
theproficientpilot@gmail.com. and it'll be on your website. You're on the email that you receive after this. So I want to thank you too, Jeff. I think this is invaluable that you're taking the time to do this as well, and helping increase knowledge, because knowledge is power.
Love that. Absolutely. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us for Cockpit to Cal, for our inaugural show of what we hope to be one that continues for a very long time. And I always like to say, I wish you all blue skies.
Good night, everybody.